Hello everyone, thank you for downloading the best of the EDN Startup Show. Today you will hear from Ravish Bellair. He's an expert on user experience, talks about starting his own design agency, his own processes and current challenges, and the next big trend in the UX design industry. You also hear from Swati Kakala, she's the co-founder of Script. He talks about her roller coaster journey from starting the company in a car to launching products at GTEx in Dubai. Next is Varun Sheth, he's the co-founder of Keto. Keto is an online crowdfunding website for individuals, NGOs and businesses to raise money for their favourite causes and creative projects. Next is Shilpi Kapoor, she's the founder of Barry Brick, which provides accessibility and assistive technology solutions to people with disabilities. And finally, Fahim Gill, he's the founder of Dashroad, based in the UAE. Dashroad focuses on bringing out data from cars to help build a platform of connected car applications. So please enjoy the show. Thank you.
Hello, Ravish.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, great, thanks. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do, please.
So Amps just currently started a design consultancy in India called Apps Culture, and we focus on helping a ton of the smaller developers and startups over here basically improve their user experiences that they provide. India is not known for the best of design, although the culture is definitely improving significantly over the past few years.
Excellent. Yeah, what inspired you to start your own business then, and how's it going so far?
So I've always loved design. Starting my own agency of sorts has been a dream for several years. I actually ran my own studio for mobile app development for several years, right through college and a few years after college. I was the first employee at Haptic, which is one of the more popular Indian startups of today. I've always had the bug to be part of the startup community itself.
Excellent. And how many people in the team at the moment?
At the moment, there's two of us. We do bring on board a few other people as the projects come in place. We've only set up shop earlier this month, so it's a lightweight right now. We're trying to keep costs low and see how things grow organically over here.
Okay. And how did you guys meet?
So we both were friends for several years. We both were organizers with what's called the Google Developer Groups. So we used to basically, he used to organize events in Bangalore. I used to do events in Delhi, and we'd often collaborate and maybe travel to each other's events. So we've known for each other for a while now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you work with companies in any industry, or is it specific industries that you target?
So it's mostly B2C companies in India, mostly a case of mobile app companies more than just the web itself. But it's mostly wider in that sense. India is a little more focused in terms of what's going on. You don't have a lot of VR going on, for example, but mostly it's B2C mobile apps that we're working with.
Okay, let's talk about user experience then. For those people who don't know, I mean, how would you define user experience in simple terms?
Just everything. Like I'm one of those people who believe that experience is literally every bit of a product itself. I've been someone who's pushed for the fact that advertising itself, the ads that you put on Facebook, is very much part of the user experience itself. So when we tried to do onboarding at Haptic, we would try to build it in right from your Facebook ads to your sign-in experience and everything. So literally every moment of seeing any, even a tweet from a company, according to me, is user experience.
Okay. And how would you define your UX process in like basic terms?
So I have personally leaned a lot towards the school that Google Ventures has pushed a lot, called the Google Design Sprints.
Okay.
That itself is based on a lot on the work of Stanford's D School. The reason I love the design sprint is, firstly, it's a great process for getting a lot of things done in a short amount of time. A lot of iterations can be done in a week itself. And what I love the most probably about it is the fact that it's very malleable. So you can change the process around based on the requirement itself. So we keep moving things around according to what's needed, the clients that we're working with or the teams that we're working with, what's the scale of the problem itself. So for example, are you changing something very minor, but you want a lot of iterations of that, or are you working on a much larger product level thing where you suddenly now need to focus a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I mean, what are the current challenges then you face as a UX designer?
So it's one of those things that definitely in India, everyone would love to say we love design, we really care about design and thing, right? When it comes to the grind, right, like when it comes to the point that we have to push out this release on this particular date or whatever, design is the first thing that's sacrificed. It's the first thing that's like, it's good enough. So changing that mindset to a certain degree is a bit of a challenge. Also getting the engineers on board to a certain degree, that's probably one that I enjoy more than anything else because I write code as well. So engineers don't spend enough time, or they don't have as much of a taste for design as we do. They obviously go through, like, as a designer, it's very simple for me to draw something and maybe like, hey, this is going to move around like this. And for engineers, it's going to be, yeah, that's like four sleepless nights for me.
Only four.
So, yeah. So it's just one of those things that finding a middle ground with them and also trying to communicate. So working on communication between design and development is an interesting one.
Excellent. What would you say with the next big trend in UX design?
The next big trend is something that's been around for a while, I would say. We've been talking a lot this year about the movement towards more of a connected lifestyle, where it's suddenly a case that you're no longer bothering just about your phone, but you're going to be bothering about a lot more devices and how they interact with each other. So this is something that a few of us used to discuss several years ago. That's going to come to this, but it's finally happening, where the experiences that you expect on your phone need to be the same that you have on your tablet, the same that you have on your desktops, on your smartwatches. But at the same time, they do need to have their own specialties on each platform, obviously. That's one, obviously. The other one that the world is waking up to now is something that has been talked about, the conversational commerce paradigm. The reason I say the world has been waking up to is because I've been working on that for the last 2.5 years at Haptic. So we've seen this. We know there's a lot going on in India on this front. We've got like a bunch, like we have over 50 companies today who call themselves personal assistants on chat. So when we guys started, there's literally no one else. Now there's 50. There's interestingly enough, there was a freelancer.com posting by someone who's like, build us a messaging app like Haptic. And we're like, okay, if you've gotten that popular, that's exactly the description that you want, even on your freelancer.com jobs. So yeah, that's something that's picking up largely because of what Facebook is doing with as part of Messenger. WhatsApp is now trying to bring in board businesses on their conversations. So these two things are going to be probably the biggest things of 2016 to me.
Excellent. So what are some of the apps and websites that you love then?
I'm one of those people who uses Inbox instead of Gmail. Inbox is definitely a big improvement to me on email. It's one of those minor things where it's just about psychology. Just the fact that they call archive done has changed me from a guy who used to delete all my emails to a guy who now archives all his emails. And I finally have reached Inbox Zero. Separately, I love Pocket Casts on Android. That's a beautiful app. Got me addicted to podcasts itself. I never listened to podcasts before. Over a period of time, I've probably started spending a lot more time on them. Previously, it used to be just a case of, hey, I'm just listening to design talks or engineering talks. Now I'm even listening to Serial, for example. Skyro, which is my friend's, the other co-founder at Apps Culture. It's a voice recorder app. It's a beautiful app that's probably one of the best across platform in terms of voice recording capabilities and some of the power features that he's built on top of it that make it a great thing to have around for every meeting. Todoist is another one. That's one of those things where I used to make to-do lists on a bunch of different apps, but I'd never last more than 3 or 4 days. I'm now... I really love making to-do lists. I keep track of everything that I'm up to. Karma points really help me be like, know that, hey, I'm actually being productive this week versus not being productive or something.
Who in the industry do you follow and read then?
A bunch of people. So Medium is obviously there. So Medium is a case that where everyone's getting pushed out to you. I do like, I'm forgetting his name. So I do try to read everything that Matthias Duarte is doing, right? So it's mostly a case of videos mostly with him. So it's talks at different places. Follow his tweets as much as I can, even on Google Plus or something or the other, because he might just drop a nugget of information here and there. It's mostly a case, I don't think the individual people as much. It's going to be a lot of FASCO design and all these other places. The individuals probably would be someone like Nick Butcher from Google's developer relations team, and also Roman Urich, again from the developer relations team. the reason I probably relate to them more than anyone else is, again, both of them are designers and developers. So you get this mix of knowledge from them. Both of them built great apps on their own also recently. So yeah, those two are probably the individuals that I follow.
You've also got a blog on Medium, which looked really amazing.
Yeah.
So please tell the listeners more about it, please.
Yeah, so I used to blog a lot before. I actually, there was a one point in time when I wanted to be a sports journalist. So I just love writing. So my recent posts have mostly been, so last year, in fact, like rewinding it back, 2014, when material design came out, I wrote a bunch of blogs called Understanding Material Design. So there were three of them trying to break down what material design actually is versus what people are confusing it to be. Got very popular, picked up by Business Insider and Android Weekly, and went through the roof. Since then, I've got this thing that, hey, I should speak as much as possible. So I go around speaking at events. I'm a Google expert for design under that category. I also, so the ones that I started now is something called effective design. The focus of effective design is to just share some nuggets of information, some lessons that I've learned as a designer who's never been to D school. So it's one of those things that how everyone asks, how have you learned design? And I just say that by actually doing it. So what are the things that I've come across? What are things that other people should probably know about? So that's what effective design is about. The name itself is a little play on the Java book, Effective Java, which was a great book that every Java developer should probably read, where he essentially taught a bunch of minor lessons that you probably would put into practice immediately as soon as you read it. So that's what effective design is all about.
What's the most interesting project you've worked on or you've seen?
Beyond a doubt, Haptic. The reason for that is when I first joined Haptic, interestingly enough, and I always tell this to everyone at a company also, is that I thought this was just another messaging app and I would probably be around only for a short duration. The original plan was just be a WhatsApp for customer care. But once we released and once we started seeing people use it, we just suddenly started enjoying, like, the challenges that started coming in from an interaction design perspective were immense. You could see how the users were using it, but at the same time, you could also see that, hey, to get the most out of this experience, this shouldn't be just another chat app. It needs to innovate in many different ways. So we came up with something that we call Smart Actions. This was essentially actionable messages. So messages in your conversation which could do something for you. So for example, you can book cabs on Haptic with just the tap of a button. Another thing that probably is one of the most complicated things we worked on is it's the in-conversation forms that we have. This is interesting because we are probably the only people who do this. The problem we were facing at the time was a lot of our users, we need a lot of back and forth asking for information and users wouldn't come back with all the information, which just stretched things on longer. So by having a form, we could actually put it out to these users that, hey, these are the things that we need and it's much more clearer to them. But we were also able to plug it in with our user profiles. So that meant that a lot of information was already pre-filled as soon as the form came in. And it also plugs in very well with a bot. Which actually means that a lot of the work that we're doing is now suddenly automated simply because we structure the data.
So tell me about an assignment that was, you know, perhaps too difficult. You know, how did you handle the situation?
So too difficult, let me see. Probably one that goes back to something that I used to work on called TwoSense. That was too difficult at one point. It was too difficult because I probably went about it the wrong way to a certain degree. This is still back in the time when skeuomorphism was popular. So TwoSense was a movie recommendation engine and we should provide a website for it. So it was the first mistake that we made back then was we went with a website versus building an app. The mistake that I say, the reason I say it is I took myself away from my development skills. And since I'm the guy writing code, suddenly it's the case that I'm learning something completely new. But the biggest mistake that I made was we kind of created this iconic movie reel kind of design. So you have these movie posters inside movie reels. And people suddenly really liked it. But from a development perspective, it was just a disaster to maintain. Because responsive web design with something as skeuomorphic as that, which is moving around, was just a pain to do. And particularly then scale it down to your mobile website as well. Ultimately, what we did with that was after trying our best to iterate on it as much as possible, we just decided, you know what, we have to get rid of this. We have to realize that even though it's iconic of our design, you have to take a step away from it. You have to get your ego out of it and be like, if you have to make a big transition for the experience, you have to give up on this. Users were obviously pissed to a certain degree. But it's just one of those things that it actually significantly improved. The same pissed users are suddenly interacting a lot more with the app itself. So trying to work through that. And definitely one of those things that you have to figure out a better way to communicate to your users why you're doing something versus the other.
Excellent. So do you have a list of favorite user experience tools that you use on your projects?
Yeah. So I've got a bunch of different ones. So obviously use Sketch for all my visual design stuff. Sketch is a great tool. If you're still using Photoshop or Illustrator, you should probably give up on it and move to Sketch. It's a great tool for doing your all your visual design. Obviously, it's one of those things that, having said Sketch, that also means that you should probably move to a Mac versus still being on a Windows device. There are a bunch of other tools also available on a Mac. For example, I use, so you probably have on other platforms as well, but Pixate is there. Pixate is something that I use for my prototyping to a certain degree. I use Pop, which is an app which allows you to choose certain hotspots in your designs and connect to each other pages. So I use that for very low fidelity mockups, which is usually when I draw something on pen and paper and be like, okay, how's this flow going to work around? I also use Alfred. So people wonder, how do you use Alfred for design? So Alfred is this tool on Mac, which essentially allows you to search for files and do a lot of other things with it. I've created a custom workflow, which allows me to simply type icon and then type the kind of icon I'm looking for. And it looks in one of my repositories, which contains all the material design icons. So the moment I just type that and press enter, I get the icon that I want in a Sketch file itself. And I can just pick it up from there and put it into whatever I'm working on. A very small thing, but it's one of those that probably saves me at least about 10 to 15 minutes a day versus going into a Finder and looking for it. And interestingly enough, and this is, I'm very glad to know that Nick Butcher is also doing this to a certain degree, is that I do a lot of my prototyping on Android itself. So that means writing my own app to a certain degree and being like, hey, how are things going to work? Because it's one of the things that a lot of older designers, for example, we talk about that web designers need to know how to write HTML5 code, that they need to be able to write a website or something and show us how it's going to work, write some basic JavaScript or jQuery stuff to make it work. As more and more designers are now focusing purely on app design, I think it's coming to the point where these designers also need to know how to write code, native code as well, and essentially be better, like be able to communicate with developers. The reason that I love it, besides the fact that I'm able to prototype in a much faster way than maybe a Pixate, is the fact that I can reuse the code that I just wrote while actually building something else out. So it'd be like a separate module that I'll pick up and put into my app. I might end up open sourcing it. Like I've done a lot of open source work as well. So yeah, these are the different things.
Excellent. So do you prefer to work alone or with a team then?
I like to work with a team. I don't think an individual designer can contribute as much as a team can. You definitely need this degree of critique going on. I do find it a case that you want your designers to work individually to a certain point, and then they collaborate together. So you've got different viewpoints coming in and then merging at one point, and you're essentially discussing the merits of each other's viewpoints. Not enough people are able to do this in India in particular, but in startups, this is largely because you can't afford to have so many designers on your team, or they don't want to take that cost, which is why we started Apps Culture as a place that, okay, you don't want to have your own design team, you can't afford it, why don't you just outsource this work to us?
Excellent. So what advice would you give anyone wanting to work in the user experience world?
I would say practice a lot. I would say definitely do a lot of prototypes, not just your own work, but definitely of some concepts of your own. So you don't necessarily need to push it out, but it's all boils down to practice. And prototype as much as you can, whether that be in Pixate or InVision or something, and share it with people. It's all about critique, ultimately. So critique of your peers and critique of ultimately the end users. So what do they have to say about it? You learn the most by doing things.
Hello, Swati. How are you?
Hi, Neil. I'm good. How about you?
Yeah, great. I believe you're based in Chennai, right?
Yep, Chennai.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do, please.
Yeah, so I co-founded Script with Karthik. Mm-hmm. 2 to 3 years ago.
Yep.
So we're the minds behind Shrink, the best compression engine for the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And we built an amazing team and have thankfully stayed bootstrapped mm-hmm. ever since we started. I love to code and I manage a pretty vibrant women in tech community here in Chennai.
Okay, brilliant. How did you start your company?
Yeah, so like I said about this community, right? Mm-hmm. So we run Google Developers Group here in Chennai
yep.
and it's a great place for a lot of geeks to get together.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in one of the events, Karthik had a mutual friend
mm-hmm.
who told us about a problem that he was facing in his own company mm-hmm. about storage,
okay.
right? So whatever he did, right, storage kept on increasing. And it wasn't even the storage that his employees generated, but mm-hmm. just storage that he had to keep aside, right, to come visit back to.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a huge problem. And as we thought more about this problem, we kind of figured out that it was never a technology problem,
mm-hmm.
but it was more of a business benefit, right? So the more storage racks a business sells, the more they're profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened as a force of nature, as most startups do. We realized that there was a problem to be solved and said to ourselves that, you know, we should be the ones to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Excellent. We just rolled up our sleeves, got our geek brains on and did it.
Okay. And what were the early days like?
So the early days were actually something out of a movie, I guess. We started out in coffee shops, in cars, and it was just a lot of sketches on, you know, coffee napkins.
Mm-hmm.
And we never really thought that we could do it until we actually did it.
You said you started in the car.
Yeah, we started in the car.
Well, was that your office then?
Yes, it was. I mean, for two people, I don't really think we needed an office. So yeah. Lot of coffee shops, a lot of horrible looks from waiters. It's like, what are you guys doing here?
What car was it?
It was a Ford Figo.
Okay, excellent. And how big is the team then? So obviously you started with two people in the car. How big is the team now?
Yeah, the team is 7 people, including us.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all the best part is all of this team got together because of the community that we created.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a huge believer of tech communities because, you know, this is where I found my happiness. And I really want more girls to find it in tech too.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, you know, being related to the tech industry, but actually coding and hacking and
mm-hmm.
building stuff.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn to code then?
It was definitely self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
I think from a very young age, I just loved to solve problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And never stuff that was actually in school, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was never a kid that ever listened to anyone or ever did my homework. And I knew that I could never work, you know, survive in a 9-to-5 job or have someone tell me what to do every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it just happened.
Going back to the product then, what's like the main features of this product?
All right. So the main solution problem that we're trying to solve is the entire data explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So the closer we get to mini computers and, you know, smartwatches and all of these things, there's a huge industry out there that is actually wasting like so many literally rooms of storage trying to store all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So our product, what it tries to do is make storage much, much smaller,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but in a way that when you actually retrieve it, it's going to be the same thing.
So yeah. Is this going to be for businesses then?
So right now it's aimed for the enterprise because we see that they're the ones who are suffering the most from this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it is aimed for the enterprise and we built a kind of a streamlined compression solution. It's not just, you know, focused on certain file types, but it actually works seamlessly across any file type that you give us. And we support about like 3,000 file types currently.
Mm-hmm.
And we do guarantee a file compression size of about 50 to 80%.
So if I have a file that's like 6 gig,
yeah.
you could shrink that to what?
Actually, we've had really good experiences with a lot of enterprise storage files, like database dumps. So we got down from 6 GB to a couple of MB. It was nearly 96%.
Wow, excellent.
Yeah.
And I believe you launched this at GTEx in Dubai?
Yeah, we launched it at GTEx in Dubai.
Mm-hmm. Were you nervous yes. or excited? How did it go?
It was exciting. We just saw the Steve Jobs movie and it felt like we were him. Okay. You know, we were these little kids in this huge enterprise setup.
Mm.
And it was like, it was the best time of our lives.
Yeah,
and we had a lot of footfall and we had a lot of people that could not believe that this could be done.
Yeah, excellent. So you started in a car and you ended up in GTEx.
Yeah.
So when you were in that car, did you think you were going to end up like...
Never. I mean, it was never about selling the product or making money or anything of that. It was just about solving this huge problem that even we faced ourselves, right?
Excellent. I mean, talking about stats then, I mean, how many customers do you have?
Six enterprise customers.
Excellent. I mean, what was it like getting your first customer then? Was it exciting?
So getting our first customer was like a graduate party. It was so amazing, that feeling that our product, the ones that we just built, is going to solve a huge problem for all these people.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And what's a typical day for you then?
A typical day involves a lot of code, a lot of looking over product development and making sure whatever we push to production is of the highest quality. I also love contributing to open source, and I encourage a lot of my team members to do the same too.
What's the hardest part about building Shrink?
Yeah, so the hardest part definitely would be trying to do something that no one has ever done before. And every single day is just not a problem, but something that we have to come across, right? And it's that entire creative process. And we get to be so curious and we get to build stuff. And I think that is hard, but when you come over it, it is one of the best feelings in the world.
I mean, what will Shrink look like in, say, 12 months' time?
So I definitely want to have this product be, you know, used by every single person, not just enterprises, because I think this is a problem that all of us are facing, right? So the more storage that we generate, I mean, our phone space is definitely not enough for anyone here. Mm-hmm. Right? So something that would actually solve this problem for everyone and not just the enterprise. Definitely that. And focusing a bit more on real-time compression. So, you know, if there was a way that, imagine this call that we're having could have been done better if it utilized less bandwidth, then everyone would be happy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So something along those lines.
Yeah. What are you working on right now then?
So we are currently in our marketing phase. So we don't have a separate marketing team or separate, sales team. It's just all of us, right? The developers become sales teams when the time starts. So right now we are in the entire marketing and sales structure right now. And yeah.
I believe you're actually working on some sort of video streaming as well.
Yeah. So the real-time compression, that is what we're working on right now. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make so right now how the product works is that you give us any file type and it actually compresses in the background. And once it's ready, it's going to ping you that, you know what, hey, I've done it. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is that just take off that huge point in space that the user doesn't really know what's happening, right? So we're trying to make this more real time. So if you give us a video and if you want to broadcast it to like thousands of people, we're going to use our technology and make this real time. So as you're broadcasting it, we're going to be compressing it and serving it. But when we serve it, it's going to be serving at full size. So only the transportation is going to be compressed.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And you mentioned marketing before. I mean, where do most of your customers come from? Is it email or face-to-face or social media?
It is a lot of emails, a lot of following up, mm-hmm. and having so these are enterprises that we have to deal with. So a lot of emailing, a lot of cold calling, and just visiting the office, right? And mm-hmm. So a lot of cold marketing. Mm-hmm.
And how do you stay on top of things? Obviously, you mentioned code before. Web development is always changing. How do you go about staying on top of things?
All right, so we work 10 hours a day, mm-hmm. even now, and that 10 hours a day is at office and the rest is at home. Mm-hmm. And I actually love the kind of culture that we've developed here. And it's never like you do this and this is going to happen. It is like, if I do this, the product is going to be better. So I think everyone really strives to do that extra 20% and get things done.
So at the moment you're bootstrapping this, so you're not looking for any VC money or anything like that, are you?
Not at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Yeah. And what's the startup scene like in Chennai then? Well, obviously we hear about Bangalore, but what's the startup scene like in Chennai?
Yeah, I've actually heard this, that, you know, the entire startup scene is at Bangalore, but I think a lot of noise is actually happening here in Chennai. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of still very humble, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so yeah, it's starting up.
And who are your tech heroes?
All right, so that's an easy one. So David Heinmar Hansen from Basecamp and Sridhar Vembu from Zoho. So both of them are really motivating and inspirational, right? Both of them are bootstrapped and they love being bootstrapped. Mm-hmm. And I mean, DHS built Rails. Who wouldn't have a little tech crush on him?
So is the code written in Ruby on Rails then?
Yeah. So the web front side is written on Rails, where the compression is a bit different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. And what books? Do you read any blogs?
I'm not really techie when it comes to blogs, but I love my daily Reddit. I love fiction. And you know what? I actually think that a lot of tech founders just need to like unplug, unravel, and kind of come off tech a little bit.
Excellent. I mean, do you have like a list of favorite web tools that you use for your projects?
So right now we just started moving it to React. So React.js by Facebook. And I think it's excellent. It solved a lot of problems that we had on the user front side and helped us make it more user-friendly, I guess. So most of the enterprise tools that you see right now are just like HTML1, right? Like just a lot of table layouts. So this is something that we're trying to solve too. So all these enterprise people, they're used to using age-old technologies, but they come back home and they use amazing things like Facebook and WhatsApp. So we try to build our shrink web portal as something that is kind of modern, right? So a lot of things that you see on Facebook or WhatsApp is going to be implemented here as well.
Last couple of questions then. What advice would you give anyone wanting to start a startup?
Just stick it out, right? No matter how hard the day seems to be, right? Just believe that tomorrow is going to be better, and definitely product first. It's okay to obsess over every little detail, because whatever you put out there, it's a little part of yourself, and that little part, it better be the best part. Mm-hmm. And also don't rush into raising funds, right? So build a little MVP, test the waters out, because there's actually a very good thing about not having a safety net. It makes you work more perfect, right? Knowing that you've got only that one chance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just stick it out, perseverance. Yeah.
Excellent. I mean, away from your business, do you have any hobbies and interests? I know you work 10 hours a day.
I love doing yoga. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I actually started convincing a lot of my team members to start doing yoga too.
Hello, Varun. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brilliant. And where are you from?
I'm from Mumbai.
And tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're building at Keto, please.
Sure. So my background is in finance. I actually was an interest rate swap trader mm-hmm. before I started Keto.
Right.
Keto is a crowdfunding platform mm-hmm. for social, personal, and creative projects. We started this 3 years back. The three of us had got together to launch something like this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We just completed our third year.
Excellent.
And fantastic. We've done around 10,000 projects, raised over 20 crore rupees mm-hmm. And impacted millions of lives.
Brilliant. Okay. And where did you get the idea from? How did this all start?
It all started close to 3.5-4 years back. Actually, I was in a TED conference mm-hmm. And I kept, I kept meeting a lot of people who had this challenge of unable to raising money. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that why is it so difficult to raise money for people? Mm-hmm. I soon figured out that, 99% of the money in the world is controlled by 1% of the people. And that didn't seem right. And the thought came that how do you democratize the whole idea of, raising money? Mm-hmm. Why should such less people have so much control? And that's how the thought came of building an online marketplace, mm-hmm. a platform which would connect people who wanted funds with people who wanted to give funds.
Excellent.
And that's how the idea came about. And of course, it's evolved so much over the last few years.
Excellent. I mean, how big is the team at the moment?
So we're growing really fast. So our team, 6 months back, we were 8 people. Right now it's 30. Mm-hmm. 30 people. We should be around 60 in the next 6-7 more months. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's moving really fast.
Excellent. I mean, how did you meet your fellow co-founders?
So my first co-founder is Kunal Kapoor. He's a Bollywood actor. Mm-hmm. We met a few years back when he was working on something similar.
Okay.
So we just met through a common connect because we both had the similar ideas and we were just discussing the same ideas with the same person. Mm-hmm. So, that person just connected both of us and she spoke about it for, a few months mm-hmm. and things worked out. So we said, okay, let's do this together. And our second co-founder, Zaheer, we went to the same school. He's my senior.
Okay.
He was a product manager in a tech company. And we were looking for a CTO mm-hmm. and, we reached out to him. We worked together on a new beta version of Keto 2.0 mm-hmm. For 4 months and then things worked out. So we said, why don't you come on board?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. You mentioned some campaigns before. Can you give me some examples of like recent campaigns just off the top of your head?
Sure. So one of the campaigns that we did was for this athlete, Shiva Keshavan. Mm-hmm. He's a luge athlete based out of India.
Right. Okay.
So he wanted to go for the Winter Olympics in a couple of years back and didn't have the necessary funds to get there.
That's brave.
So he launched a campaign on Keto, and he was able to reach his goal of 1 million. To raise the required funds to go for the Sochi Olympics in Russia.
Excellent.
So that was a really interesting story. Another one was of this girl named Shweta Kati. She actually was a sex worker's daughter, and she was picked up by this nonprofit in this area called Kamatipura in Bombay, and she was a really bright and brilliant student. And through all her hard work, she actually got into a university in the United States, and which of course gave her a full scholarship. But she needed funds to actually get there and, you know, cover her living expense and traveling expense for the first 12 months before she could start earning. And we put up a campaign for her. And yeah, because of that, she was able to get there. And now she was actually voted as a top 25 under 25 by CNN Newsweek. And she's been giving a lot of TED conferences and she's become, something that everyone looks up to as a ray of hope in India.
Excellent. So when you started this, did you think you would get these numbers?
No, actually, I had not thought about it that we would get till here as well. So it's, you know, every day has been a learning curve and we've learned a lot as we grew. And we're just hoping to help a lot more people in the coming months and years.
Excellent. I mean, what kind of obstacles did you get getting this off the ground? What were the early days like?
So the major obstacle was, the biggest obstacle was user education. So how to educate users to use an online platform to raise funds, because the concept is still so new globally. So it was still more difficult to educate users in India because users in India are just getting used to e-commerce and just shopping online. So something like this was a little ahead of its time. But so that's been a major challenge. And I think, you know, through the whole network effect, people are learning from each other because of success stories and the media support we've got. You know, the user learning curve is getting faster, but we've only hit 1% of the market till now. So there's a lot of headway and growth that can be achieved.
Excellent. So let's move on to crowdfunding then. What is the crowdfunding scene like in India then?
It's fairly new and it's growing really fast. There are tons of people who are looking at crowdfunding now as a potential medium to raise funds. So we were getting 12 months back, we were getting like 2 or 3 campaigns a day. That number right now is around 40, 50 campaigns a day. So that's just answers the kind of user education that has increased around crowdfunding. There are tons of success stories as well that are coming out of people crowdfunding and, you know, reaching new heights. Like recently, there was this company called Safer, which is a gadget company. And they were at a prototype stage and they crowdfunded on Keto. And because of the kind of traction they got and awareness and reach they got, they actually were able to close an angel funding round of $1 million 3 months after crowdfunding.
Wow.
So that's a common trend actually globally, which is working out in India as well, where companies that are crowdfunding at a prototype stage and are successful doing so are being able to raise, angel funding from investors.
Excellent. So if anyone wants to crowdfund a campaign, what advice would you give them? Any tips, any do's, any don'ts?
Sure. So the most important tip is to be as transparent as possible, be as detailed in terms of information as possible, because generally crowdfunding is something where people think, where that you put up a campaign and the funds automatically come in. So basically, yeah, that's a misconception people have of crowdfunding, is that you just put up a campaign and, you know, somebody or the other just randomly start putting money in. So that's something that, you know, people should be aware of. It is a lot of work. It takes a lot of time, effort and commitment to successfully crowdfund for a campaign. So that's a very, very important tip, is that if you cannot allocate enough time, you should not crowdfund.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's talk about you then. What do you do on like a day-to-day basis? How do you manage your day? What takes up most of your time? Obviously speaking to me, but...
So yeah, so since you know our team is scaling up, of course the idea is to create new partnerships, which is something that takes a lot of time. We're working with a lot of people to bring them on Keto. There are a lot of events that we're doing to increase education. We're increasing our team. From a product perspective, we're creating a lot of systems where nonprofits and campaigners can better manage their donors, their funders. So there is a lot of work that is going on there to keep increasing traction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you a first-time founder then? Have you done startups before? Is this your first one?
No, this is my first one.
Mm-hmm, okay. So did you quit your job and then do the startup?
Yes, I quit my job.
Okay. And what were your reactions? What were the reactions of the employees when you told them that you were quitting?
They were pretty shocked because anyone understood what I was trying to do back then.
Yeah.
So they all thought I'll come back in 6 months, yeah. But yeah, that didn't happen.
Okay, cool. And what would you say the vision of the company is?
The vision of the company is to give everybody an equal opportunity to raise funds for whatever they want,
mm-hmm.
for any cause they want, mm-hmm. any project.
Yeah. And what's been the highlight at your time so far at Keto?
The highlight has been the lives that we've touched and the people that we've helped. Like, we get random emails and postcards, mm-hmm. of people thanking us for starting Keto, people thanking us that we did something like this, which allowed them to raise funds. There are tons of people who raise funds for medical assistance and help as well. Those emails and messages and postcards are something that really drives us to work harder.
Excellent. So what are you actually working on right now then?
So right now we're just about to launch the third version of Keto. We call it a Keto 3.0.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of new design, new features, new social media integrations that we feel that will allow us to connect deeper with, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram,
mm-hmm.
that we're just about to launch. We're also, looking at a potential opening the platform for campaigns outside India.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at trying to target Indonesia and Philippines as the next markets to enter. So those are some interesting things that we're doing,
mm-hmm.
In the next few months.
Okay, cool. Last couple of questions then. Who do you admire in the tech industry or any industry?
So in India, I think people that I feel really really look up to is of course the Flipkart guys, Sachin and Vinny Bansal. I think they've built something really interesting. And they scaled it to something unique and something really big.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole approach of how they went about is pretty fascinating and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And globally, of course, Elon Musk is someone that we all look up to.
Mm-hmm.
He's driving innovation at a pace that no one is. And that too in industries that no one else is looking into and taking risks bigger than anyone else as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these two guys are the ones that are really doing some interesting stuff.
Okay, cool. I mean, do you read any books, any blogs you can recommend?
So recently I read this book, what's its name? Wait, I can tell you. In blogs, I just follow your TechCrunch, mm-hmm. and your TechCrunch and TechAsia.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the books that I read. Those are blogs that I follow closely.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I read this book called The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Network Age.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually by Reid Hoffman, the guy who started LinkedIn.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's a really interesting book. I think anybody who's trying to hire a lot of people and manage talent, which is one of the most key things for any startup, needs to have a look at that book.
Excellent. If anyone wants to do a startup, what advice would you give them?
Advice would be to keep trying. If you believe in your idea, there is a way through. And if you keep trying in different ways, you will find a way,
mm-hmm.
to make your startup work.
Hello, Shilpi. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Excellent. And whereabouts in India are you from?
I'm from Mumbai.
Excellent. Awesome. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what Barrier Break is, please.
So I'm what I call a graduate in sociology.
Okay.
Who is a self-taught technologist.
Okay.
Along the way.
Yeah.
Used to be a white hacker. Okay. Worked for an American firm sitting out of India back in 1995.
Yeah.
And had the opportunity of working with a boss of mine who was paralyzed.
All right, okay.
And that's actually what spurred Barrier Break. So Barrier Break is really a company that would look at technology for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And in a country like India, where I can't necessarily change infrastructure, mm-hmm. the aim was, can I use technology to become more inclusive and to provide people an opportunity?
Excellent.
And that's really what Barrier Break
cool.
is about.
How long have you been doing this now?
So effectively, we started out in 2002.
Okay, long time ago.
Yes, and then 2004 was when we set up the company and seriously started doing some work in this space.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And how big is the team now then?
Oh, we are now a team of 85 of us, mm-hmm. And 75% of us have a disability.
Okay.
We work across all disabilities so that people can get included not only from the technology aspect, but mm-hmm. even as an organization that we are diverse.
Excellent. Going back to 2002, what were the early days like then?
So the early days were more about looking at the US and saying, oh, there's something called Section 508 and India is a tech hub. And shouldn't all these great software companies want their products tested so mm-hmm. that they could meet their compliances? Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, it was about failing because none of these tech companies really wanted to work with us because yeah. they weren't really looking for Section 508 compliance. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a challenge. It was a challenge to get the IT sector to look at us. Mm-hmm. It was also a challenge from the government's perspective because India had no mandate on accessibility. Mm-hmm. Actually, even today, we do not have a legal mandate on it. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, that was a huge challenge. And to go and tell government officials that, there's this thing called accessibility and assistive technology and you need to embrace it. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge challenge. And slowly and steadily, what we had to do was so as to survive, we had to look at the West and we had to start working for companies all around the world. Mm-hmm. So as to overcome the India gap and, wait it out till India was mature enough to have our services.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I mean, when you started, did you think it was going to be as big?
Well, I'd hoped it would have been bigger faster. but I think we're doing very well today. But I think there's yet a long way to go and a huge opportunity out there from an India perspective.
Mm-hmm. So is this a funded company then, or have you bootstrapped this company?
Initially, I bootstrapped it, mm-hmm. got invested in by a venture capitalist,
okay.
a social venture fund. For that matter, 2 years back, we bought them back. Mm-hmm. And that was a great achievement for us because that came out of our own profitability. Mm-hmm. And we decided not to go with another investor. So mm-hmm. today, we are fully owned by the organization. We don't have any external investors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a great place to be in because we can keep trying new things like our latest mm-hmm. mobile app that we've just launched called mm-hmm. NewsHope, which is the first accessible news app in the world.
Right, okay. Cool. So have you developed that software yourself and in-house?
Yes, not only developed the software, we're also running an entire news team around it, mm-hmm. As well as obviously the mobile app is accessible to visually impaired people, but also we're providing sign language support in the news, mm-hmm. Which is making it really interesting because I don't think there is any other news app out there which provides sign language news mm-hmm. today in an integrated format.
No, can't think of anything. How long has that taken to get off the ground then? Is it now live, is it?
It went live last Monday.
Okay.
we're as new as that.
Yeah.
It's going to be an interesting, fun journey.
Mm-hmm. I mean, have you had any feedback so far on the app?
Oh, yes. We met with 1,000 deaf leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've done is we've simplified the English.
Okay.
So what we do is we give a summary, a short, simple summary of a news item, and we link to a news media site.
Mm-hmm.
for the full news.
Right.
But the kind of feedback that we've got from the visually impaired as well as from the hearing impaired has been fabulous on, you know, there was a need for them because they had no access to news.
Mm-hmm.
In India, we only have sign language news that comes for you at 6 o'clock in the morning for 30 minutes.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. So they actually have really no news for them.
Mm-hmm.
And for the visually impaired, you know, most of the mobile apps of the news papers are inaccessible to them.
Mm-hmm.
So a huge challenge out there. So I think the feedback's been very positive.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping that next week when we organize an event called Tech Share,
yep.
we'll actually take it out to the masses and let them see it and give us feedback and start from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about this event then. Is this something you do every year then?
No, interestingly, we do this every 2 years.
Every 2 years, okay.
So it's called Tech Share India. It's in partnership with RNIB,
okay.
As well as an organization called NCPEDP out of India.
Mm-hmm.
The aim was that in 2007, I was sitting at CSUN. And I said, you know, I can afford to come to CSUN, but how many people can from India? And if all of the development is happening in India, then are we talking about this
mm-hmm.
back home? And that was really the genesis of TechShare. We've now run it for the fifth edition. This is our fifth edition next week.
Mm-hmm.
So we have about 30 stalls. We've got some fabulous sponsors from a Microsoft to a Google to an Accenture to an Adobe to a Pearson
mm-hmm.
who are there in support. And it's amazing to see, people put up assistive technology stalls in India. So we have about 30 stalls that are being put up
mm-hmm.
and about 50 plus speakers that will be talking across, assistive technology and accessibility as the key focus areas.
Mm-hmm.
So should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have about 800 to 900 people that we expect within mm-hmm. those 2 days. And the exhibition should have about 3,000 people that walk in and see what are the kind of products out there. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to it.
Excellent. Sounds exciting. So going forward then, what are the sort of like technologies that will be used mostly by disabled people in years ahead, say? Would it be like wearables or 3D glasses or something like that? I don't know.
I think there is a need for all of these. I think the wearable is surely a very interesting space for people with disabilities, whether it is to control your environment or, you know, to look at your health or to assist you in basic things like even your alarm,
mm-hmm.
right? Today, if you don't have your phone on you, how do you know that the alarm went off?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you can vibrate with a wearable, it would be fabulous. But I think the challenge for people with disabilities and wearables is going to be you can't wear 20 different wearables. Right? And I think the key is going to be that, you know, which are those one or two wearables that are the key and within which how many other people put in applications that are built on top of that. So I think that's the way for people with disabilities. I'm not sure
mm-hmm.
From any other perspective, but and I think when it comes to all the latest technology out there, I think mobile, at least for India, is the most revolutionary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you can put anything and everything on it,
mm-hmm.
it's the way to go from a disability perspective because the reach it gives you, I don't think anything else does.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think the future is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Good stuff. So can you give me any like personal stories of people you've helped get work or trained, just off the top of your head?
Sure. So we'll talk about a person called Amit, and he is a support engineer,
mm-hmm.
Is low vision himself.
Mm-hmm.
When he joined us, he was yet starting to be a graduate.
Mm-hmm.
In his journey with us, he has learned to actually learn about all the technologies across disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Today is one of the most independent people I've met who can go around India and speak about our solutions
mm-hmm.
as well as to some extent sell our solutions in a very compassionate manner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what's really interesting is that when you see people like him who didn't have an opportunity or even something as simple as when he went to give his exams while he was working with us,
mm-hmm.
having the opportunity for him to take a portable magnifier with him
mm-hmm.
and do the exam and this help him become a graduate, I think they're all stepping stones for us. Mm-hmm. Right. On the other side, if we look at, we have an autistic kid who works with us, mm-hmm. right? And he is one of the best. So we also convert textbooks for visually impaired people into digital talking books. And in our process, we also convert math books. Mm-hmm. So when you think of autism, you don't necessarily think math. You mm-hmm. don't think equations because you think they're very difficult and mm-hmm. how to cope with it. And here is this kid who is fabulous at taking maths and creating MathML out of it, right? And writing MathML. And you just wonder that, he might not understand the equation himself. Mm-hmm. But he understands what he's seeing and he knows how to write it in code. Mm-hmm. So that's such an opportunity out there to find people and to find what they're good at and to make it happen for them. Mm-hmm. And I think those are just some of the stories from our own experiences.
Excellent. What are you working on right now then? Anything interesting?
So I think it's TechShare for sure. Also on the 3rd of March, we are doing a virtual award for the first time. Okay. It's called Global Elevate.
Right.
It's about technology innovation, which have happened between, which have been developed between 1st of April 2014 mm-hmm. to 30th of October 2015. Mm-hmm. And this will be a yearly award that we'll give out. And it's been interesting that we've had 46 nominations that have come in from 14 different countries around the world.
Wow.
And if you see some of the solutions, some of the solutions are solutions which today we would probably spend, $1,000-$1,500 buying, and people are looking at how to pull down the cost of some of those innovations mm. and make them happen in under $100. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So I think there is a huge opportunity for innovation today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be the next big thing. So Global Elevate will be given on the 3rd of March. Mm-hmm. I think from a UK time, it's going to be around 3 o'clock in mm-hmm. the afternoon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking to do the first ever virtual award in the accessibility space.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned innovation. What's been the best innovation for you over the last 10 years when it comes to disabilities?
I think the mobile phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so.
Right. And I think specifically also because the mobile phone today, unlike in the case of the desktop, has a lot of accessibility features that are coming out of the box, right? So something as simple as, word prediction on every hand mm-hmm. is just fabulous, right? There was a time that we would have paid a packet to get a word prediction software, and today each and every keyboard that all of us are using mm-hmm. has word prediction on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the mobile phone has really changed the way all of us interact with technology, and the same thing will apply to people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. So, anything that frustrates you at the moment?
Oh, lots of things.
Yeah.
The way society looks at people with disabilities, mm-hmm. even now, the gap that exists even today. I think NewsHook, from an accessible news perspective, was my way of saying why, I've knocked on every door with every newspaper saying, can you make your app accessible? And if they don't want to do it, fine, then I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is surely a frustration point at most times. But I think the good part of it is you walk into office, you see these fabulous people,
mm-hmm.
Ready to fight again the next morning and make it happen. And you say, oh, yes, let's get at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you keep on top of things technology-wise? Because obviously it's changing all the time.
I think the web helps.
Mm-hmm.
I think getting to conferences around the world and seeing what everybody is doing helps.
Mm-hmm.
I think beyond that, dreaming mm-hmm. is the most important one. What do you dream of, and what do you think is the potential of technology?
Mm-hmm.
So like we say within Battery Break, we have about 100 products that we dreamt about that we'd like to build one day.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be one product at a time because of our own limitations. But I think all of those make it happen.
Excellent. Last couple of questions then. What would you say is the vision of the company? What's the long-term vision of the company, say in 20 years' time, 30 years' time?
So I think we've come up with a fabulous tagline. It says, creating a limitless future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the vision of the company. Can we help technology be that tool that will help people create opportunities, that will help build inclusion, that will you know, basically people see the potential of themselves rather than anybody else having to see it mm-hmm. for them. And I think that's really the vision of the organization.
And who do you admire in the tech industry then, or any industry?
I think there are a couple of people. I think Elon Musk for sure. Mm-hmm. Steve Jobs is an obvious from what he has managed and, you know, delivered to the people. Mm-hmm. So I think there are quite a few out there. And it really makes you stand up and look at it from a company perspective. Of, you know, what Google has managed to do is something phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So I think there are lots of people to look out for and look up to mm-hmm. and hope to get somewhere near them in life.
Mm-hmm. And what books or blogs do you read? Anything you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, I am a startup geek, if I can say that, entrepreneurial in every spirit. So I read anything that's startup oriented. Mm-hmm. I read, entrepreneur.com, Harvard Business Review. I think some of those things, the kind of ideas they give you and how they make you think about how you can take disability and align it with a business model and an opportunity is mm-hmm. just fabulous. I think there's a book called Start With Why mm-hmm. By Simon Sinek.
That's
the best books that I think everybody should read, specifically in the disability space. And why is it that we do what we do? I think we lose track of it mm-hmm. along the way.
How would you describe your leadership style then? Are you a hands-off person or?
So I used to be very hands-on. Mm-hmm. But now I've learned to be hands-off and only get hands-on when I have no other choice. Which hopefully should not get to that point. Mm-hmm. But I think my leadership style is more about I let people do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. But I do monitor closely enough to ensure that we don't land up in the wrong space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If anyone wants to do a startup in the tech for good environment, what advice would you give them?
Do it now. Mm-hmm. Huge potential. Mm-hmm. An audience which has not been targeted. And thus, the gaps are huge. And if you find a niche that you think and you believe that you can make a difference in, I think it's a fabulous opportunity. I think it's one where you can enjoy working, making money, as well as knowing that you've done good to a whole lot of people, mm-hmm. Which I think is a fabulous place in.
Excellent. Last question then. For people who want more information on Barry Bake, what must they do?
Well, I think follow us on Twitter mm-hmm. for sure. We are as Barry Break or me as Shilpi underscore Kapoor. Mm-hmm. Come to our website. I think we tweet a lot. Mm-hmm. That's one of the best places to get to know us and we respond. Mm-hmm. So drop us an email. Our website has our contact information. And just drop us an email and we'd be happy to write back.
Brilliant. Fahim.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks for coming on the show today.
I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. And whereabouts are you calling us from?
I'm in Dubai at the moment. Headquartered in Abu Dhabi, but I live out in Dubai.
All right, cool. Awesome. Tell me a little about yourself and what Dash Road is, please. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, so I am an engineer. Spent 15 years in the auto industry with Toyota and Honda designing some of the cars.
Yep.
They're on the road in the U.S. Some have made it to the Middle East. So anywhere from exterior design, structural design, did some connected car stuff like blind spot monitoring, nearly wave design. So essentially that kind of had me, I kind of had an understanding of how the auto industry life cycle is for new vehicles.
Yeah.
And just in 2010, I got my MBA and went to work in Silicon Valley as a portfolio manager.
Okay.
So I made the switch from engineering to the business side of the world and realized that there's actually quite a bit of happening in the auto industry that is actually catered towards startups, and that's something I wanted to do. But the idea for Dash Road actually started back in 2010,
right,
with a couple of friends from undergrad who were working with other startups, and we were going to do this on our own. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like in 2010, it was a bit early for the market. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, it should have been better if we started back then because it was actually a good time to start. Mm-hmm. But so the idea essentially started to make connected car technology as an aftermarket play. Mm-hmm. And so we started with that in 2010, put it on the shelf. 2015, I really started being in Dubai, where there's a large car culture, and a lot of people are actually pretty open to new technologies, even the government. Mm-hmm. I figured, you know, better late than ever, let's go for it, see how it goes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And things actually, we've been, we were founded in February of 2015.
Okay.
And getting through the red tape and what have you took us some time. In October, we got approval to start selling our devices here. And that's the time I got invited to join Flat6 Labs, which is an accelerator program based in Abu Dhabi.
Excellent. So what actually is the product and how would I go about using it?
Yeah, so essentially it's a simple plug-and-play black box you plug into your car's mechanics port, the onboard diagnostics port. So what makes our device different than, say, automatic is that we have a SIM card that's embedded in the device that is connected 24/7. And from there, you can get lots of data. Mm-hmm. And we basically built a platform on which you can build various different apps, such as emergency calling. If you get an accident, the device will call for help. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is you just get this device, you plug it into the mechanics port, and you're done. Mm-hmm. The vehicle is... when you power it on, the vehicle is live, the device is running, and data is incoming to us. Depending on the use case, because right now we're looking at the business-to-business model, for fleet companies, these guys want to have a dashboard where they see all the information versus a mobile app. Mm-hmm. On the consumer side, that we're thinking of entering in the next, say, 6 months, there would be a mobile app that is part of that as well. Mm-hmm. We're actually developing the mobile apps right now, but it's a question of what do you go to market with first. Right now we're looking at the B2B side.
Mm-hmm. Can you share any stats then since you started? How many have you sold?
Yeah.
How many do you plan to sell over the next 12 months, etc.?
Yeah, sure. We got approval to start selling in October of last year. Mm-hmm. We joined Flat6 Labs Accelerator Program, and from there we kind of refined the product and made it for a specific market, which was the fleet management side, which a lot of people are doing. The value add we're doing is we are actually doing it at a lower cost, but we're doing it in a way that actually it protects privacy for the driver and also gives the end customer or the fleet manager the information he needs. So because of this, what we're doing is we're going for a niche market within the fleet management side as well. So what we've done so far is we have pre-orders for over 1,000 units, and our goal for the first year for 2016 was 1,000 units. So we already have enough demand for our product. The flip side of it is we have to sustain that, and we're looking to launch up our team so that we can actually expand and start selling even a bit more aggressively, so we can actually meet the demand that's out there.
You mentioned a team. How big is the team at the moment then?
Right now, it's just three of us. Mm-hmm. So we really need to ramp that up, and that's basically our bottleneck right now. Excellent. Normally for companies, I don't think, I think maybe for startups, the manpower is the bottleneck where you have to have the engineers and on staff to really get this going. But the reality of the situation is the market is huge, and we anticipate at least 600,000 units that would be sold in the UAE alone. Mm-hmm. And we are just, you know, touching just the surface of it right now.
Okay, excellent. So you were part of an accelerator. What did you get out of it? And did the product actually change during that time you were in accelerator?
Yeah, both things happened. We got a lot out of the program, which I was actually surprised because going into these accelerator programs, they kind of tailor it towards somebody who doesn't have much experience working, right? Like fresh graduates or people who just have a couple of years of work experience. So I had a bit more work experience. So I kind of had the feeling that I really don't need to know how to do a financial analysis or financial modeling or what strategy you want to want, right? Yeah. But the reality of the situation is you pick up these tidbits here and that become really powerful that add to the overall experience. So I'll give you an example. So we had Google Design Sprints come. Like, we did a Google Design Sprint. Mm-hmm. So you would think that if you are, you know, doing an MVP product and you're using the same tool that everybody else is using, such as InVision or Sketch or Illustrator, that making a... an MVP that's like in the material design scope, if you read the documentation, you get it. But the reality of the situation, it's the experience you get when you're working in that environment that really is different than what you can learn online. So when Google came down, they had us do different exercises, which really, when you're doing it and competing against other teams internally, it does make a difference. So one example was you take this piece, like 8.5 by 11 or A4 piece of paper, fold it, I think four times or two times, and you get a 8x2 matrix. So you want to make an app. Say your listeners right now, they have an idea for an app. Mm-hmm. They take this piece of paper, fold it, take an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, you fold it once longitudinally,
yep.
Then once horizontally,
yep.
And one more time horizontally. So now let's see, what do we have here? So I just did it here while we're talking.
So am I.
And I've got 2, 4, 6, 8. Yeah, I have like an 4x2 matrix on the piece of paper. Now what you have is 30 seconds to make a sketch for your landing page.
Yeah.
But they all have to be different. But each one you can't spend more than 30 seconds on.
Right. Go. Okay.
Right? Ooh. So you read all this stuff about how to make a landing page, how to get people to, like, what's a call to action, this and that, right? But now you're timing yourself 30 seconds to make a sketch. You have to make 16 or 8 sketches, I'm sorry. Yeah. 8 sketches and 30 seconds each. What ends up happening when you do that is you get all sorts of different ideas. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you're doing this as a team. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have some biases and some thoughts on what you want on a landing page. Somebody else has it. But when you're timing yourself and doing this quickly, you'll come up with something that you were not expecting at all.
Excellent. Cool.
So this is kind of stuff that you would get an accelerator, right? You don't expect to really, maybe some people expect to get a ton out of it, but you get a lot of small things here and there that help you in the long run. So while we were part of the accelerator, we also had access to a lot more folks you would if you were doing a startup by yourself. Mm-hmm. For example, the Geeks on a Plane guys from 500 Startups came down. And we sat with them and got to basically talk to these guys one-on-one. Mm-hmm. That was invaluable in the sense that what 500 Startups does is they focus on, you have to have like an MVP, you have to have a certain amount of traction, and you get into the program and they really help scale it up. Like one of the startups that came into the program from Abu Dhabi, they were able to increase their sales 6x in the program.
Wow.
Of 500 startups, right? And they were saying if they had a bit more a refined product, it would have been much more. Yeah. The point is, like, the Geeks on a Plane meetup gave you insight into marketing strategies, which are proven to work, that you wouldn't have gotten if you didn't have that access. Mm-hmm. So you get a ton of tidbits here and there that really, when you're done with the program, really differentiate you from the other startups mm-hmm. that are in the local ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. What is the startup scene like in United Arab Emirates or Dubai and Abu Dhabi?
Yeah. So there's the two big Emirates are Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Dubai is the media and financial center, more or less, and Abu Dhabi, which is physically the larger emirate, is also the headquarters for the government and is where a lot of the government resources are. And we were based in Abu Dhabi, Flat 6 Labs is. So the ecosystem in the past few years has really expanded greatly. So I've been here 3.5 years. When I came here, there were a handful of startups. Mm-hmm. And you go to these meetups and you could basically meet the biggest startups mm-hmm. there, because there really wasn't much of an interest, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now it's like, I would guess, like everywhere else where startups are like the in thing to do. Mm-hmm. But one thing you don't realize is that it's not that easy doing a startup, right? It's like you take a financial hit when you do a startup. Like, even though we have funding, it's like if the opportunity cost of doing a startup versus working for corporate, you almost 9 times out of 10, you're going to be better off if you're working in the corporate environment. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that is the mindset, right? The mindset's always been that everybody works in the corporate environment and that's where you'll be successful. Mm-hmm. But now on the other side of the coin is there's a lot of people who are interested in doing a startup because they think, well, they could be that 1 out of 10 that's going to really, hit it big.
So what are you actually working on right now then?
I can't say. It's something that's in the connected car space.
Yeah.
But it just came about, I would say, in the past week. Mm-hmm. Right now, what we can talk about is we're doing driver behavior analytics for the shared community, right? Like the Ubers of the world and the Kareems of the world.
Yeah.
These guys, they have their own drivers and don't want to get feedback on how they're driving. So we can help with that. So mm-hmm. that's something we're doing right now. But there's a couple of things we're working on that are actually going to take that to the next level. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. I've been to Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and the driving's really bad. I mean, what do you think, guys?
Yeah, I think statistically, it's actually one of the safer places to drive.
Right.
UAE is one of the safer places. I think it's like 106 in the UNHCR stats. Mm-hmm. In safety, so it's actually relatively safe mm-hmm. yeah. driving here compared to, say, other places in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia, and I've heard Egypt is pretty bad, and Lebanon's pretty aggressive also. So basically, the driving behavior here is just a subset, I guess you could say, of habits mm-hmm. because. For example, like with Dubai and the UAE specifically, 80% is expat community. Mm-hmm. When you look at the stats of who has most of the accidents and fatalities, mm-hmm. number one is India, number two is Pakistan.
Okay.
Right? So regionally, UAE is safe, but it's relatively safe. But when you start looking into the data,
yeah.
Actually, India, there's some bad driving habits coming out of India. And my guess, and I don't know, I've never been to India, so I don't know, but from the photos I've seen, it seems like there's a lot of congestion in the urban areas.
Yeah.
So people don't really drive fast. So your reaction time in a place in India where it's congested and you're going 30 miles an hour, you can react slowly. But say when you come out to the UAE where speed limits are 120 kilometers and people are driving faster, you have to react quickly and you have to actually anticipate what's going to happen before it happens, right?
Yeah.
So because of these situations, you have drivers from all over the world coming here and they have different driving habits.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is normalize those driving habits and help create a better driving behavior and experience for mm-hmm. for expats specifically.
So do you think this will like lower costs when it comes to like insurance as well, if they have this device?
Yeah, so that's the one thing. Insurance in the UAE is actually really high. In Saudi Arabia, it's really high when you compare it to the UK, the US. Like, for example, it'll cost on average about $1,100 to insure a vehicle in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So you insure the same vehicle in the US, it's about $1,300 for the same benefit, the same plan, right? Mm-hmm. That same vehicle is about $2,300 in the UAE and about $2,400 in Saudi Arabia. So when you look at reducing the insurance costs, there is data that says you can do it, and you might reduce your top line revenue for an insurance company, but your bottom line income will go up because your net income is going to increase because the cost of repair and claims will be going down as you make these drivers better. And that's the that's essentially what we're going to be working towards in the future,
mm-hmm.
is to help reduce the overall cost of it in the UAE and eventually the Middle East.
Cool. So let's talk about you then. What takes up most of your time then on a day-to-day basis?
Mostly it's just managing the team and trying to close some deals. So
mm-hmm.
this is one of the areas when you're a startup, you are essentially just going full-time all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have time to really look for all the different, you know, productivity tools that can help improve your work environment. Like I'm using the same like methodologies that I use at Toyota, essentially they taught me at Toyota, which were like the lean engineering tools that most people don't even know about. Mm-hmm. And they can help you get far with a lean team. Mm-hmm. But I don't use all the latest apps and products that are used by other startups, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at them, but at the end of the day, using the Toyota methodology actually works pretty well. But given that type of environment, I do have to manage the engineering team and also go out there and source new business. And so those are two aspects that take a lot of my time.
Mm-hmm.
The third aspect would be just regulatory issues. Make sure that all the legal issues are handled. So, but that doesn't take up too much time.
Okay. Excellent. You mentioned Toyota. Did you work on any interesting projects during your time?
Oh, yeah. So, prior to it, I was with Honda, and Honda probably was more exciting.
Okay.
But they both had exciting projects that I worked on. At Honda, where I started, I worked on the current generation Acura MDX, which I don't think is sold in the UK. I don't
know. We offer.
Yeah, I don't think it's sold in India either. But at Honda, they really encourage you to become the best engineer. So they encourage you to do all sorts of things that you want with their product. So I joined their rally team, and so I started off as a co-driver for Honda's rally team, and eventually moved to the driver's seat.
But
at one of those
brave.
Well, at the last race I did with Honda, there was actually I think two fatalities.
Wow.
And I decided that I need to do something else, so I joined Honda's motorcycle race team.
Okay.
so that was a lot of fun. But then after that, I got recruited by Toyota. I went to Toyota and I worked on the Toyota Venza.
All right.
Okay. Toyota Avalon. The Avalon I worked on actually sold in the UAE. So I see it here every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last part of the Avalon was exterior design for the front. But while I was at Toyota, that's when I was doing the connected car at Honda. When I was at Honda, I was doing some of the connected car stuff with milliwave radars. And one thing that might be of interest would be that when I was leaving Toyota in 2010 to go to Palo Alto to work in banking, the project I was going to work on was going to be the Tesla RAV4. So it was going to be the Tesla EV in a RAV4.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I need to try something different, because after you do the same type of work for so long, you kind of need to try something different to challenge yourself. Mm-hmm. So I moved out there and tried doing some pretty interesting things there in the banking side. But at the end of the day, I wanted to create something. So I decided to get back into the engineering side. Mm-hmm. And hence, I'm back in the automotive space with Dash Road.
Do you think the Tesla will take off around the world then?
Yeah, I'm sure it will. The one thing that's really interesting is that the entire auto industry is changing now. Because you've got Faraday Future coming in. Tesla has basically proven that electric vehicles can work. So now Faraday Future's coming. VLF just said they just have started working on a prototype. So back when the auto industry first started, you had a ton of small motors companies or engineering motors or vehicle companies that were popping up everywhere. And the same thing's happening now. So essentially, it's almost like the internet. When the internet first started, that's what happened in the auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
So Tesla seems to be the poster child for that. But there's actually a lot that's going to happen before Tesla or the electric vehicle or autonomous vehicles take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially the play we're working on. If you can imagine a world where you have autonomous vehicles, the entire infrastructure for the roads will change, the entire way you insure a vehicle is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's going to change when it comes to transportation if you have autonomous vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
For startups, there's tons of opportunities.
Yeah.
So we are positioning ourselves to be in that space. Before autonomous vehicles, you need to do a ton of stuff in the infrastructure. And essentially, that's what Dash Road is doing. We're starting off with something small, and we're going to build upon that.
Sounds exciting. Last couple of questions then. What books or blogs do you read? And how do you keep on top of information?
Under 500 pages is Why Nations Fail.
Okay.
So that's actually a really good book, because it tells you the history of how countries have fallen and how they've come out of nowhere. Essentially, it's like an accelerator. There's a lot of tidbits you can pick out of it that can help you in the startup world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm halfway through with this book. In terms of blogs, I really don't read too many blogs.
Mm-hmm.
Wanda, which is like TechCrunch for the UAE or for the Middle East, I read that every now and then. But mostly, the main thing I do is just hang out on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And just on Twitter, I follow like TechCrunch, Mashable, Wanda, and just a few influential folks. Like, while I was in Silicon Valley, like there's some folks I knew there that have not started doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And just, just follow these guys. So
mm-hmm.
more or less.
Talking about Silicon Valley, who was the most interesting person you met?
While I was there?
Yeah.
that I can share would be...
Drop a few names, come on.
Well, you probably don't even know them. That's the thing.
Oh, right, okay.
So the one guy was... I'm forgetting their names now because you put me on the spot, but...
But what was it? What was it about this person that was amazing?
Sahil. He's the guy who started Gumroad. So,
all right. Okay. Yeah. I use Gumroad.
Yeah. So, yeah. He was like 18, 19 at the time, and it was just I was looking for some stuff done, and he knew some folks I knew, so just kind of just exchange some messages here and there, and he's done well since then. Mm-hmm. Another guy was here's a good person. Jeff Lawson, who's the founder of Twilio.
Okay, yeah, he's Twilio. That's cool.
So he's an alum, and I went to the University of Michigan, and they flew us out while we were in grad school just to hang out and get to know more alum. And he came in wearing a backpack and looked like a regular student, started chatting with him, and then he says, well, he's working on telephony services. I don't remember exactly what he said, and ended up that he was running Twilio, and I didn't know anything about Twilio at the time. So when I started looking into it, I just realized that this seemed like it would be a pretty interesting thing. But the thing that was interesting was the first startup that he did, I knew about that one, which was, I think it was like Varsity Books or Versity Books, something like that, that had to do with selling books online. So I knew about that. So then he started working at StubHub. So once he started telling me all this stuff, I realized that he was actually not just an alum or just a guy wearing a backpack. He was actually somebody that's done some pretty interesting things.
What's the best advice you've received so far?
Best advice. The one I keep on hearing all the time is if you have to fail quick and pivot. Mm-hmm. I would say that's the most consistent advice I've heard, because advice is one of those things that if you know what you're doing, if you feel comfortable doing what you're doing, just go for it. Mm-hmm. Because everybody will give you their opinion, but at the end of the day, you're the one in charge, right? Mm-hmm. So if it fails, it's on you. If it does well, it's on you. The advice is just secondary. But one of the advisors or mentors from Flat6 Labs, what he told me was, at the end of the day, all investors you go to are going to look for the bottom line. Like how much are you going to grow, or how much are you going to make them? And that might be a mindset for the UAE investors, but it's one of those things to keep in mind is focus on making revenue. Don't focus on growth.
That is the end of the show. If you liked it, please leave a rating or review of the show. Just search for the Indian Startup Show on iTunes, Stitcher, and we are now on Spotify. If you're building something exciting, please send me an email, hello@neilpatel.co, or tweet @IndianStartupSH, or go to facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. We'd love to connect. Thank you and goodbye.